Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, preparing for coastal hazards. Your home is one of your greatest financial investments. When a natural disaster occurs, the results can be devastating. We talk about reducing risk as well as common myths and reasons to prepare. Joining us is Shannon Holtz. She's Deputy Director of Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, floodplain and CRS specialist with Cooperative Extension and HUE Sea Grant. Hi, Shannon.
Good morning, Mindy.
Brian McCormick is Coastal Processes and Hazards Specialist with Cape Cod Cooperative Extension and HUE Sea Grant. Hi, Brian.
How you doing?
Great. All right, you guys have put together this handy homeowner's handbook to help people prepare for coastal hazards. It's an update, right? So this is what volume? This is the third in the series, right?
Yep,
so
this is the third edition.
So tell us a little bit about what this handbook entails. It covers a lot of ground.
Yeah, it certainly does. And as a lot of people see, there is a ton of information out there when you're looking at coastal hazards. And you'll very often get emails from a utility provider or get information from the news. And we wanted to get all of that information in one place so that you're not hunting around for all the different sources.
Right. So what kinds of hazards, Shannon, are we talking about? I mean, hurricane comes to mind, but there's a lot more than that, right?
Right. Yeah. So coastal hazards, the book is titled Coastal Hazards because we're really looking at our coastline. So we're primarily looking at tropical storms, which include hurricanes, and extratropical storms, which are our nor'easters. So our nor'easters, we are very familiar with those. We get those all winter long. So those are our primary storms that we're looking at. But these can also churn up some other things like thunderstorms and even tornadoes. That this can help you be prepared for all of the potential hazards that you could encounter.
Right. So tell us about the joint program between HUE Sea Grant and Cape Cod Cooperative Extension.
Sure. So this program has been in existence for a few decades. The folks who were in it kind of figured out that both programs were doing similar work and they ought to combine forces. So Sea Grant is part of a national network of Sea Grant programs. Every coastal state has at least one, and ours existed. We happen to have two. We're lucky to have two in the state of Massachusetts. We have one with HUE and one with MIT. So HUE, being right here on Cape Cod, was able to connect with the county, and now we have this joint program where now we have six staff that are joint staff between the two programs, and we're able to draw on the resources of both the county, Barnstable County, and HUE, which is wonderful to have access and wonderful for all of the folks here on the Cape to have access through us to both of those as well.
Yeah, for sure. So coastal storms, as we mentioned, can have hurricanes and nor'easters, which nor'easters probably being the most common. Tell us about the difference. And, you know, it's funny because we used to have a listener say, it's a nor'easter, not a nor'easter. So tell us a little bit about the difference between what is a nor'easter versus a hurricane?
Yeah, they are both extremely powerful storms, but they get their names from where they form. And so hurricanes are tropical storms. They're formed down in the tropics, and there's a main development region that we keep an eye on when we're looking at that formation. Where nor'easters, they are forming more off the coast, generally between about Georgia and New Jersey, and then they like to swing up the coast, and there's different factors that go into their formation where a hurricane is going to be a warm core storm, and so that's really feeding off of the heat in the ocean, where a nor'easter is mixing of warm and cold air. That's really driving that low pressure system.
Yeah, and the wind. Sometimes you look at the winds in a nor'easter and they're close. They can be close to hurricane strength, right?
Yep, they can get extremely high. And so when we talk about hurricanes being, you know, the most powerful storms, it doesn't discount the fact that nor'easters are still extremely damaging and something that we have to prepare for.
Yeah, depending on when they hit, too. If they hit when we still have the leaves on the trees, uh-oh.
Yep, you get a lot more windage on the trees, but you also have those leaves coming down and clogging storm drains, which can back up floodwaters.
Right, exactly. So hurricanes, we have different categories, and that's based on the wind speed, right?
Yep. And so you start off with a tropical depression, and a lot of people discount a tropical depression as, oh, it's not a hurricane, we don't have to worry. But that in and of itself is still an incredibly powerful storm. And so that, as it escalates, goes to a tropical storm. And that is a very powerful storm, something that you hear about, we keep an eye on. But once we get into the Saffir-Simpson scale, which is how we classify the categories of hurricanes, you're looking at least 74 mile an hour winds. And so I always like to give people the idea of, if you're driving down the highway going 60 miles an hour and you put your hand out the window and you feel that wind speed, that is constant. And it goes way beyond that in a hurricane. Once you get to categories 3 and 4, you're looking at major hurricanes, things that have potentially catastrophic damage.
Yeah. I know 74 doesn't sound like it's that much, but we just look back to the last hurricane we had, which was Hurricane Bob in 1991. And that was really barely a hurricane, and it did quite a bit of damage. And if you think if we had that same, you know, strength hurricane now, with so much more being built up, there would be a lot more devastation, I would think.
Yeah,
that's one of the things that we look at is the increase in development. Bob was a relatively minor hurricane. Our last major hurricane was in the 50s. So one of the things that we do when we do outreach presentations to the public is we look at a comparison between what was developed then and what is developed now. And we have a massive increase in the development in the areas that are most likely to be affected by hurricanes. So that's why we try to work with our communities to make sure that whatever development we do have, especially moving forward, is built in a safe way so that we have as minimal as possible loss of property and any risks to health.
And one of the things too, you know, we have it for some people, you know, 1991 was a while ago. There probably are folks here who have not experienced a hurricane before. And I'm always amazed at when it gets really bad, how many people rush down to the water, to the ocean, to see what's going on. I'm thinking, well, are you crazy? You know, I mean, it can be so unpredictable, right?
Yeah, we have to admit that we are among those people, but we are doing that as
but
part
you're paid
of our job.
To do that, yeah.
Yes, we are part of a team at the state called the Storm Team. We go out after storms and we assess damage, and it goes right back through an app called MyCoast that anybody can use to take pictures of storm damage, and it goes right back to the state so that they can see what kind of damage is actually out there from this storm in real time, and we let them know, you know, if there's something like an exposed septic, then we will get a phone call right away with them asking for more information. But yeah, for the general public, we don't necessarily encourage folks to go do that. I mean, storms are really interesting. But if you do that, you know, make sure you're being careful. Never drive through floodwaters. You don't know how deep they are, especially if they're moving. 6 inches of water can knock a person off of their feet if it's moving. A foot can float a car. You know, we might think, oh, well, we live on Cape Cod. Are the storms really that bad? Well, we haven't had many recently, but it doesn't mean that they can't be that bad. And we've even seen areas where the roads have been washed out. So on the Cape. So if you tried to drive over it, you know, you'd be in big trouble.
Yeah, so gotta remember, sand, right? It's sand. Sand moves. Yeah.
Right. Sand moves. Right. And then when you have pavement on top of sand, pavement really moves when there's sand underneath it. Yeah. So there's a lot that can be going on there.
And just as a reminder, you actually have some photos in the handbook of some past hurricane devastation, just to remind us, right, how bad it can be.
Yeah. And, exactly.
And then also the other thing you do, you're saying at the end of the storm, but you also look a lot at coastal erosion, even in more minor storms, right? I mean, because there's certain areas that are sort of known for that, and you're out there, right, to monitor what's happening.
Yeah, we take a look at pretty much every beach out there to see what that erosion looks like, not, like you said, just in the major storms, but day to day, because we have waves coming in nonstop. And every single one of those waves can move some sand. And so we think of the episodic events, the big storms, but knowing how that sand moves day to day gives us a great idea of what we can expect in those larger events.
Mm-hmm. And we now see, you know, there's everywhere around the Cape and the islands, we have areas that are kind of low-lying and flood on a regular basis. But now we even see flooding when there isn't storms, right? What do they call that? Sunny day flooding?
Sunny day flooding.
Yeah.
So that happens when we have extreme high tides, what are called, quote, king tides. So we have certain days a year, every year, where things line up so that the tides are especially high. It typically happens in September, October, November, but they can happen throughout the year as well. And we are starting to see high tide during those events back up through some of our storm sewers. And so you'll have a puddle of salt water on the road, even though there's no storm surge, or you can go to the beach and there is no beach because the tide is so high. So yes, that's and we have lots of pictures of that too, and we try to take that on sunny days so that people really understand, you know, there's no storm behind this. This is just changes in sea level.
Yeah, exactly. And then on top of hurricanes and nor'easters, we now do see tornadoes, right? I mean, that's something I don't think we were used to seeing very often. I know when I lived in the Midwest, tornadoes can be, as you know, devastating. You don't know where they're going to hit, right? You can kind of guess, but at least with a hurricane, we have a little more warning. We know it's coming. We can prepare. Hard to prepare for a tornado.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. So tornadoes can spring up during during events where coastal storms are happening. So tropical storms, extratropical storms, and our expertise is in those storm systems themselves. And the tornadoes are newer for us too because they are springing up more where they didn't before. But a lot of the advice in the handbook can help you prepare, not necessarily prepare your home for a tornado, but it can help you prepare yourself and any needs that you might have and your family might have right after a tornado.
Yeah. So before we talk about emergency kit, I just want to talk about evacuations for a second because, people, and we see this on the news all the time where there's some kind of, natural disaster and people are told to evacuate. Some do and some don't. That's a serious, when you have officials telling you to evacuate, it's serious and you should listen, right?
Yes, that is something, a message that we always try to hammer home. If an official tells you to evacuate, we want you to evacuate because it's not just your own life that might be at risk. It's also the life of any first responders. So if you have an emergency and then you call 911, then those first responders are putting their own lives in danger to come rescue you. And, you know, a heart attack doesn't stop just because there's storm surge surrounding your house. So we want to get you out for your sake and also for the sake of those who it's their duty to come rescue you and protect you, but we don't want to put those folks in any unnecessary danger.
Are we seeing changes in storm surge? Is it typical, the same all the time, or are we seeing areas, as we're seeing sea level rise and warming temperatures, is it changing?
Yep. And so, like you mentioned, it really depends on the storm, but it's always going above that sea level. And so storm surge is just that bulge of water that's added on top of any tide. And so when storms hit at high tide, you get a way bigger bulge of water than you may expect from that typical tide. But we have seen that it's gone up with sea level rise because it's pretty much just additive. But again, it depends really on the storm itself and how much water it can push. So smaller storm with a little bit lower winds, you'll see lower storm surge. But those really big storms that we see, they can throw a couple feet of water on top of a tide.
One example we saw of that was the 2018 storm is our storm of record now, the January 2018 storm. And that is only our storm of record above 1978, talking specifically along Cape Cod Bay. 1978 was the previous storm of record, and the only reason that 2018 beat that storm surge record was because of sea level rise. So the 1978 storm surge was actually larger, but we had just enough sea level rise between 1978 and 2018 that a slightly smaller storm surge in 2018 ended up causing more flooding because of the additional boost from sea level rise.
Right. We're talking about preparing for coastal hazards. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about preparing for coastal hazards with Shannon Hultz, Deputy Director of Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, Flood Plan and CRS Specialist with Cooperative Extension and Hui Sea Grant, and Brian McCormick, Coastal Processes and Hazards Specialist with Cape Cod Cooperative Extension and Hui Sea Grant. They put together this homeowner's handbook to prepare for coastal hazards. If you have comments or questions, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so we hear a lot about having an emergency kit ready. You've got that covered in here. But what should it include when you want to put an emergency kit together? What are we thinking should go in that kit? I guess, first of all, it should go into some kind of plastic container, right?
Yeah, you definitely want to have it in something that's waterproof so that you're keeping everything nice and dry. But a lot of it is basic things like water, clean water, food. A NOAA weather radio is going to be critical if you lose power or cell service so that you can still have an idea of what's going on. And then things like a change of clothes, where if you do get wet, having dry socks is going to feel really nice in a storm. Mm-hmm. And so we go through a whole list in the handbook of things that you'll want to keep handy. But one thing we try to keep in mind when we're telling people about, you know, put all this stuff into a bag and have it ready, is the weight of those things. You want to make sure that if you have to leave for any reason during a storm, you can actually carry all of this stuff with you. And so we hear a lot of people that have a bag of the critical needs, clean water, food, important documents.
Medications,
yes. Thank you. But they also keep some stuff in the back of the car, and you want to make sure that you check on this stuff regularly so that if you do have food in there, you don't want it baking in the hot summer sun during hurricane season. You want to make sure that you have this stuff that's going to be usable when it's ready.
Right. Makes sense.
We also want to encourage folks to, so Mindy, you mentioned medications, also anything that you or your loved ones need on a daily basis, medications or other medical assistance like oxygen, then you need a power source. We also want to encourage people to not forget your pets. Mm-hmm. You probably are bringing your pets with you if you're evacuating, so make sure you have enough food, water, their medications, treats, toys, whatever, anything you need for them as well.
Yeah. I think we even put toilet paper in ours. Yeah, and
good idea.
Yeah, that's a good, but it's a good idea. I hadn't thought about being able to carry. We have it all in one kind of big thing, but maybe it's a good idea to have those extras like the toilet paper in something, and then the essentials, as you're saying, in something that you could carry out if you needed to, right?
Yeah. And we do encourage waterproof containers, especially if they're sitting on the floor, say, of your basement, which is where mine mm-hmm. is. But you could also, if you have those things in a backpack, you could put the backpack on top of the waterproof container so that, you know, if there's a little water in your basement, it doesn't quite reach the backpack. It's important to make sure it's mobile and you can get it out with you if keeping it in the car isn't an option.
A boat bag. The boat bags, you know.
That a
you
boat bag.
Yeah, right?
There we go. Yep.
Nice and handy, right? And I guess, you know, because it's been a while since we've had a hurricane, you also want to kind of go in periodically and check in, like, if I put that water back in 1992, right? So you want to make sure that every now and then you go in and kind of go through your emergency kit.
Yep. What I do is I have my backpack at home that's ready to go all the time, but there's a couple cans of beans in there that go great with rice. And so I jump in every 6 months and I'll use those for cooking, throw new ones in, and they last for a couple years, but you definitely want to check any expiration dates that are on anything perishable in your emergency kit and make sure that you're swapping them out from time to time.
Yeah. And you mentioned the NOAA radio, and I think that is a weather radio is a really important thing to have because, you know, we rely on cell phones now, right? If we had a hurricane, there's no doubt some cell phone towers are going down, right? And who has a landline anymore? We're going to have no phones for a while. So how are you going to get any information? That is key to have, you know, one of those wind up radios that gives you a little charge if you can't power. I mean, batteries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that that's a really important point to remind folks of. We haven't experienced that much, so they might not realize that, but cell phone towers either go down or are so overloaded with people trying to reach their loved ones or get information that you often can't get a message through. So don't be surprised if you have a hard time communicating. So those no-weather radios are great to just have an eye on what the forecast is, what weather's coming. And Mindy mentioned that they often give a little charge as well. There are a lot of things now, like little lights as well, that can offer charges because we do rely so much on our cell phones. And eventually, those cell towers will go back up. You want to keep those phones charged as
Yeah,
well.
absolutely. You mentioned pets as well, and I'm thinking, sometimes when we have, evacuation centers, a lot of times it's at the high school and things, and people are reluctant to leave their homes because they go, well, I don't want to leave my pet. And we now have a lot of those emergency shelters that will take pets, right? Some do, some don't.
Yep, you definitely want to check to see if a shelter is accepting pets before you go. But it's bringing the pet, making sure that you can secure them at the shelter. You can't really have them running around.
Right.
And so they'll typically have to be in a crate if you're going to be there. But you also want to remember things like food and water for your pet so that if you are there for a couple days, that your pet has everything they need as well.
Yeah.
We encourage folks to think of shelters as kind of the last resort. So, if you have family nearby or within driving distance, that you're able to drive to and stay with them, we encourage that. Also, if you're in an area that hasn't been evacuated and you have all your supplies, then you can shelter in place and stay in your home if it's safe to do that. The shelters are we try to keep those for folks who have no other options and are being evacuated, because they can easily get overrun,
Yeah.
if everybody goes to those shelters.
Right. And there's so many people who have home generators now, too, which is helpful. I know we had a power outage and it was in winter. I don't remember when this was, but my neighbor now has a generator, but she didn't, an older neighbor. And we actually cooked dinner in our fireplace and then brought dinner over to her. And we're like, what are you doing? She's like, she didn't, again, didn't want to leave her dog. She like was, under the covers with the dog staying warm. But you'd be surprised what you can cook in a fireplace, right?
Our old New England homes coming in
Yeah,
handy.
most, yeah, a lot of us have fireplaces. All right, so let's talk a little bit about things you can do to your home that improve safety in a serious storm. There's a lot of things you can do. And obviously, you're probably not going to do all these things at once. So talk about and some of the things. I guess looking at your roof is a big thing, right? Because that's a thing that can come off in big winds. So what do we want to, what are some of the things we want to look at as we're assessing the risk of our homes?
Yeah, one of the first things that you should do is just take a walk around your property. Take a look around, think about what's going to come down in a storm, if anything, and take some photos too so that you have a record of what the property looked like before a storm. And when you go through, if you see roof shingles that are curling up or missing, it might be something you want to look into. And there's a bunch of different options for replacing roofs. You have your asphalt shingles, you have metal roofs. And so there are different costs associated with these kinds of things. And so it's worth going to a builder, a contractor, an architect, and having that conversation to say, hey, I'm concerned about this happening to my home. What are some options I have to ensure that the roof stays on, whether it be a new roof with a different material, or even something as simple as little hurricane clips that help tie the roof to the walls of the house so that as that wind is coming in and generating a ton of lift, it actually helps hold everything together.
Hurricane clips. See, I never heard of that before. And what are some of the other things you want to look at as far as the house is concerned?
So you definitely want to take a look at one of the easiest things you can do is check to see if you're in a floodplain. And if you are, then there's a chance that you're going to get water. And even if you're not, and we like to say, Shannon's going to love this, anywhere it rains, it can flood. And so
Exactly.
you want to think of where water can get into the house. And if you expect it, you can start to look at your foundation, and that can go anywhere from filling in a foundation, adding flood vents to let that water in and out, all the way to elevating an entire home so that you bring it above that expected flood level.
Right. We see that a lot on some of the houses right along the coast now that are remodeled or, you know, knocked down and rebuilt. They're all up higher now. Is that a new kind of regulation?
Yeah, so that's all tied into the building code. So in Massachusetts, we have building code regulations that are actually stricter than federal standards. There are federal standards that every community that participates in the National Flood Insurance Program is required to follow. All of our communities on the Cape and most on the islands as well participate. So we're all beholden to these regs anyway, but Massachusetts has looked at that and said, you know, they're older regulations, our maps are older. So they've built in some factors of safety to account for larger storms that we can see and increases in sea level. So yes, the Massachusetts Building Code is requiring houses to be elevated higher. Those flood vents are required that Brian mentioned. They allow the water pressure to equalize rather than having a lot of weight and pressure pushing on the outside of a hollow foundation, which can crack it. And depending on if the home has a risk of waves, then it has to be built a little bit differently. So say along Surf Drive, for example, in Falmouth, you're going to see them built up on piles and maybe with walls that can break away really easily with wave action. This is all based on regulations and safety during flooding. So a lot of what we recommend in the handbook may be required by the code anyway, especially when it comes to flooding. It is likely required. Some other things are above and beyond.
Yeah. And, you know, I think all of us, if we look around in a heavy rain, we can see where the water starts to pile up, right? So that would be a good indicator of where you want to start and try to find a way for that water to flow away from the house.
Yeah, you can certainly look into improving drainage around the house. And you see a lot of people these days use temporary flood barriers to try to keep the water away from the house. And those can be very effective.
Like sandbags?
Yep, sandbags. Mm-hmm. They make these big plastic sheets that clip together. But if you're going to use those, you are displacing a lot of that water. You're going to send it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so when you put these out, you want to try to keep them as close to the house as possible so that you're not pushing out more water potentially onto a neighbor's property.
To your neighbors, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And are there other things, you know, would things like, you know, sometimes you might have a basement that has a little spot that leaks and, you know, big storms. Would some of that, you know, waterproofing paint or anything, does that work at all or is that not really effective in a big storm?
It can. It depends what kind of storm. If you are in a floodplain and you've had a little bit of groundwater or rainwater that gets into your basement, that's not going to do anything for a storm surge. But if it is just a little bit of rainwater, I had the opportunity to speak with a lot of folks in Woods Hole a few weeks ago, and some were well outside of the flood zone, but were concerned about rainwater. And that is something that can work. For rainwater, you can also get a sump pump to get it out. Mm-hmm. But if you are in a flood zone, the best thing you can do is get your utilities out of your basement, actually fill the basement in. And I know I just heard people gasp.
What?
I know we love our basements. I know.
We're gonna store all our junk.
Exactly. So we encourage either a little bump out or even if you can store things in the attic, because the basement can jeopardize the entire house because it is a hollow space and water is very heavy. If you don't either fill that in or allow the water to enter through flood vents, it can crack the foundation and then your whole house is compromised. Mm. So we don't want to see your whole house be compromised. So we'd rather have you find other places for storing all the junk.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure you get, well, you know what? My house was fine during Hurricane Bob. I'm good.
All the time, Mindy. We get it all the time. we do. And my response to that is I that's great. You were lucky in that situation with that one particular storm, with the angle of approach, with the time it hit, the tide it hit at. Just because you did not get wet during one particular storm doesn't mean you can't get wet with a different storm. And we have had some sea level rise since Hurricane Bob hit. So the likelihood of flooding is a little bit higher now as well.
Yeah. And now when we hear a hurricane is coming, and especially one that we think can do some damage, a lot of people, you know, put the you know, wood panels,
shutters
or, you know, plywood, right? So is there one that's better than another? Like if you invested in the shutters, are they as good as the plywood or?
Yeah, they are. There, that's we've got a whole section in the handbook that we go over window and window coverings, because windows are once you get your roof tied on and everything tied down to the foundation and your flood venting sorted out, your openings are your weakest point, so your windows and doors. So having you can the plywood works. It works great. The thing is, you have to be there to do it, and you have to know how to do it. You've got to have all the hardware to do it. You've got to have your ladder. You've got to be able to reach all the windows. Whereas the storm shutters, you can roll right down, and they're pre-installed, and you can roll right down. But those are, of course, more expensive as well. So both of them work. The plywood and shutter approaches work, and there are all kinds of different types of shutters, just depending on what works for you in particular. But we do encourage, especially if you are close to the water, to look into either plywood or storm shutters of some variety.
And people are going, wow, this is starting to add up to a lot of money here, but you just do one project at a time, right?
And you can look at, again, the plywood is a lot cheaper than storm shutters. So you could start there, and then, in a few years, if you want to upgrade to storm shutters, then you could do that.
All right. So what about assessing our landscape? You know, we got large trees maybe next to the house. Do we want to think about, as I mentioned, we did that when we bought our house back in 1997. We went around, and my husband, being a native, said, you know what? This is the one that's going to, the way the winds go and all that, this is one that's going to fall on the house. And so we did go around and take down some trees. We planted different trees, smaller trees in different areas, but that's something worth looking at, right?
Yeah, definitely. You can get an idea just by looking at the height of the tree. Think about if it came down, would it actually impact the house? And if it will, it would be worth talking with an arborist, see, you know, get a professional opinion on it. But if you're going to take down a bunch of landscaping, one thing that you want to be aware of is that a lot of that vegetation helps to hold the soil in place as well. And so if you're getting a lot of runoff erosion, that vegetation can help. And so it's you definitely want to make sure that the house itself is safe, but you want to try to keep some of that natural vegetation in place to help stabilize the entire property.
Doesn't have to be a big
we
tree,
should also
though, right? Right. I mean, it doesn't have to be a big tree. It could be other vegetation.
Yep.
Yeah.
You can plant grasses. You can plant
shrubs.
Really, yeah. Anything to help, you know, absorb some of that groundwater and keep things in place.
Yeah, become a gardener. Yeah, okay. Yeah, Shannon, go ahead.
We should also note that if you're located in a floodplain or near the water, you are likely within the jurisdiction of Conservation Commission, so you will need a permit to remove any vegetation.
Yeah, right. But also, and as you mentioned, Brian, it's not a bad idea to talk with somebody, an arborist, who can tell you, yeah, this tree might be a problem. This one. And they see things in the trees that we don't see. You know, like I have a tree I really love, but I had to take part of it down because there was some dying happening in part of it. But, you know, I wouldn't have seen that. And, you know, you see this sometimes when you see the trees that come down in a storm and the inside is all rotten. And the outside, it looks great. But an arborist would know that.
Yep. And that's one thing that we really want to stress for any of these home upgrades is calling a professional that does this for a living. Make sure that you're doing things the right way, following building codes, wetlands regulations, and making sure that things are how they should be. Mm-hmm. We can give you good information and a good place to start, but we can't tell you who to call, when to call. You have to really get an idea of what your property needs and then kind of go from there.
And you can get more than one opinion. Right?
Yep.
I mean, a lot of these folks will give you, free estimates, right, to tell you what. And then, again, it can be taking down trees can be expensive. So maybe as a priority, you start with one that's maybe the most causing the most risk and, move on from there as you can afford it. Right?
Yep. Yeah. And one of the things that we see is sometimes those trees are on your neighbor's property.
Right.
And so a lot of resilience and prepping for storms becomes collaborative within a neighborhood too. So talk to your neighbors about these kinds of things and try to get everybody on board.
All right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about preparing for coastal hazards. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Shannon Holtz, Deputy Director of Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, Floodplain and CRS Specialist with Cooperative Extension and HUE Sea Grant, and Brian McCormick, who's Coastal Processes and Hazard Specialist with Cape Cod Cooperative Extension and HUE Sea Grant. So one of the things, you know, we talked about shelters, evacuation planning. If you're going, I mean, with a hurricane, we have a lot of notice. And if you're going to leave, you better leave soon, right? I mean, the whole evacuation route stuff really is kind of a joke. It's that we're not all getting off at the same time, right? So if you see a really bad hurricane, I mean, you think you want to leave the Cape or the islands, you better do it soon, right? I mean, like a couple days before.
Right. Yeah. You always want to do it no matter where you are a couple of days before, but especially here, one islands, you've got a ferry involved. You got to get across on that ferry. And then with the Cape, of course, we have the bridges. We all know what the bridges are like. They are narrow. Traffic slows way down. So if you want to get off, yes, it's best to get over those bridges sooner rather than later. And then if you see traffic backing up and you haven't been evacuated and you can shelter in place, then we do recommend that you do stay in your home if you're not in a floodplain, if you're not likely to see significant damage from that storm specifically for exactly that reason.
And so how would you make that decision? I mean, I guess category four coming, I'm out, right? But I mean, what goes into that decision of whether you're going to stay or go?
Yeah, so it's all about assessing your own level of risk and how what you feel comfortable with. So one, certainly, if you have been told to evacuate by an official from your town, police, fire, anyone from your town, you should absolutely go as soon as you can. If you feel uncomfortable, if you are in a floodplain, you might want to go then. If you just feel like I don't feel like I'm going to be safe in this place, then if you have family to go to, go ahead and go visit them and pay close attention to the forecasts. One thing that we are seeing change more recently is storms are intensifying so quickly that sometimes we don't even have those few days of heads up from the forecast because they just can't keep up with how they're changing. But still, the best you can do is keep an eye on those forecasts and really listen to the meteorologists and the warnings that the National Weather Service is putting out there. And most of all, listen to your municipal officials if they tell you to evacuate.
So you bring up a good point about the forecast because you'll see, you know, you're watching, you know, meteorologists and they're saying, okay, a European model has it going this way. And there's and you see all those little strings of where it could go. And that changes quickly. And so, yeah, you're right. So you got to really kind of keep your eye on it to know what your risk is going to be. How do you know you're in a floodplain?
Wonderful question. Well, one, you can call our office. Hopefully when you bought your house, if you bought your house the 90s or more recently, you should have been told at closing whether or not your house was in a floodplain. But if you don't remember, you're not sure, you can look it up on FEMA's website. You can look up FEMA flood maps and you'll find it. But I have found that some folks find those maps difficult to read. And that is one thing that we do regularly is folks will call us and ask us to help them understand their flood risk. You can also call your town and folks within your town will also know how to do that. Yeah. So there are a lot of resources that you can call to find out.
And the flood maps have recently changed, haven't they? So you might think you're not in a floodplain when you bought the house, but now you are.
So actually are on the Cape, they have not changed since 2014. And same with islands, it's 2016 and in most places. They're actually not due to change in the near future. However, that doesn't mean our flood risk isn't changing. Mm-hmm. We do have a new model called the Massachusetts Coast Flood Risk Model from the state of Massachusetts. And that tells us flood risk today in 2050 and 2070, taking sea level rise into account. So it's not that the official floodplains have changed, but our flood risk is changing. And that model is the best available data that we have to tell us what your flood risk is likely to be now and in the future.
Yeah. All right. So you both go around and look at the erosion after storms like nor'easters and everything else. What goes into ideas of, you know, of modifying that? I mean, we hear all these different things, you know, you put in, you see like on Nantucket where they put in the sand on the beaches, which has to be the right kind of sand. I mean, there's so much that's involved when you're trying to mitigate erosion, right? When do you say, you know what, Mother Nature's winning here, Nothing we can do.
Well, I'll tell you that Mother Nature will almost always win. Not a good person to pick a fight with. But there are a bunch of different strategies. And so you can have nature-based solutions, things that are biodegradable, like fiber rolls that you can put in place to try to stabilize coastal banks. You can also put in things like sand fencing so that over time you're trying to rebuild dunes, build that storm buffer from these natural features. You can also sometimes, depending on the regulations, get into full coastal engineering structures, things like revetments. But all of these are going to come back to how they're designed, what they're intending to do. And for many locations, we talk about relocation where it becomes too expensive or too severe to stay in that spot and try to mitigate the erosion, where you may have to sometimes pick the house up and move it further back on the property. Or if there's not enough room on the property, you may not have any other option rather than just abandoning the property itself.
Right. Or selling it very cheap and somebody gets a couple summers out of it, right?
Yeah. Yep.
But the revetments, that's tough because you're just sort of putting it, the erosion downstream a little bit, right? I mean, in most cases, yeah.
And so those are all regulated under the Massachusetts Wetlands Protection Act. And so most houses that were built after 1978 are not going to be eligible for a coastal engineering structure, something that isn't natural. And a big part of the reason why is that we put a bunch of them in back in the 50s, 60s, and we started to see the adverse impacts, where when waves come in and hit a solid structure like that, a lot of the wave energy either bounces off as a reflection or it will wrap around the ends as word escapes me. Yeah. But you'll see a refraction around the ends. And so you can actually start to increase the erosion on the fronting beach or at the ends. And that's why I say you're not going to win a fight against Mother Nature. That sand is going to go and she's probably going to get it somehow. But if you are that concerned and think you need a coastal engineering structure, then you're going to want to talk to your town, talk to an engineer and figure out if you can do it and if it will work.
Yeah. Right. One of the things I want to talk about, too, is that you mentioned My Coast and Coast Snap. This is so cool. Who wants to talk about it?
Yeah,
Brian,
I can.
You both do, yeah.
I can give some insight.
Yeah.
So Coast Snap is a community science project where we're just trying to get people interested in the coastline. We are trying to get people on the beaches, although that's not very hard to do around here. But just get them thinking about that change over time. And so CoSnap is a little cradle where all you have to do is walk up, put your phone in the cradle, snap a photo, scan a QR code that's going to be right there for you, and send it in. And that all comes to us, and we now have this series of photos over time where we can go back and see not only the change from, you know, big storms, those major events, but that daily change that we want to try to keep track of too. Mm-hmm. And it goes beyond, you know, the interesting science that's behind it. It just gets people engaged with their own coastal resilience.
Right. What do you want
and
to
right
say?
And right now we have posts in Sandwich, Brewster, Nantucket, The Vineyard, and New Bedford. And Brian keeps saying you might want to put one in Falmouth if we can. So keep an eye out for more.
Yeah, it'd be nice to get more of them, right? Is it a grant that funds this? Is that how you pay for these?
Initially, it was. That's what got it started. So we partnered with Rhode Island and New York Sea Grants to put them in all three of those states. Now that grant has run out. So now we do it out of our HUI Sea Grant budget. We also try to partner with the town to maybe pay for the fabrication of the post. And we figure out where it's going to go and get it sited and everything. So now it's usually more of a collaboration between us and the towns.
And how many? You've got thousands of pictures, right?
Yeah,
we do. Brian, go ahead.
We have, like you said, thousands of photos. And the original installation was at Town Neck Beach in Sandwich, and we have one facing east and west. And I think from each of those, we have well over 300 photos looking in each direction. But We recently, just this past summer, put in new posts in Brewster and New Bedford. And those posts alone in the past 6 months have each gotten over 100 photos. And so people are really taking an interest in keeping track of that change.
That's, I mean, very cool to be able to see, right? Because they're dated, right? So that you know when the photos were taken. And of course, there's a difference in the winter beach and the summer beach. But over time, it will be really interesting to see the changes, right?
Yeah. And anybody can go and look at these photos. They are on the MyCoast website, and you can go back and see the full log of every photo that was ever taken. And so you can go through and see those day-to-day changes yourself. And like you said, there are some seasonal changes. So people who are only here in the summer, they can go in and look at, you know, that winter beach and see that difference.
Yeah. It's interesting, too. You should get one in Falmouth. And I've told the story before, but I got married in 1991, and we actually had a beach party on Surf Drive at the end of Elm Street, right? That's how much that beach has changed. You couldn't do that now. There's not enough room to do that. I wish I could say how much. I don't remember, and I don't have photos from it. But it'll be interesting as we go, you know, time to see which areas have the most erosion, right? And then we talk about erosion, but there are also areas like areas in Provincetown where the beach is increasing, right?
Yep. And so in all of this sand movement, you'll have sources and sinks. And so we look at the start as a source, and all of that sand moves through what we call the littoral cell down to a sink. And so all of that cross-shore movement is going to have erosion and accretion at different places, at different rates. Some of that sand is moving offshore into deeper water. But there are places that get significantly more sand, like some places in Provincetown, by Rock Harbor. You'll see a lot of sand building up over time.
Mm-hmm. Are these photos just of the beach itself, or are they people photos? I mean, when people, you know, people kind of jumping in and, you know, waving or whatever, are these supposed to be just of the beaches?
So we definitely want you to take a photo with the family if you can, but we are mostly interested in the beach itself. So if you could take two photos and send us the one of the beach, that'd be great. But you do see some photos on the website of people in those photos, but you can still see most of the beach behind them. But we definitely want to encourage people to, use the photo station for whatever you need, but that beach photo is...
That's what you want.
That's the prime time.
A little data collection there. And I know you're not insurance specialist, but if you're in a floodplain, you should have flood insurance, right?
Yes, absolutely. We very much encourage folks to have flood insurance, even if you're not in a floodplain. As Brian said earlier, if it rains where you live, then you have a risk of flooding. But absolutely, if you're in a floodplain. And we have 9 towns that participate in what's called the community rating system, and that helps save money on flood insurance premiums. So if you are in one of those 9 towns, you can look on our website. They're listed there. You can have anywhere from a 10 to a 20% discount on your flood insurance. So it's not as expensive if you buy it through the National Flood Insurance Program. There's also the private market that you can buy it from. You should, we recommend people go to their homeowner's insurance company and ask them if they offer flood insurance, and then get a couple of quotes both from the private market and the National Flood Insurance Program. Typically, the National Flood Insurance Program is cheapest, with the most coverage, but not always, depending on certain situations. It's important to remember that insurance isn't going to cover everything, mm-hmm. but homeowners insurance does not cover flood damage. So if your whole home is damaged from flooding, you may not get anything if you don't have flood insurance. So we strongly encourage folks to look into flood insurance.
I have to say, boy, that wind deductible and the homeowners insurance has gone up and up and up and up,
yes.
right? Yeah, I know. That's exactly. That's a whole nother show, right?
It is. Exactly.
All right. And then so where can folks get this homeowners handbook?
From cgrant.hui.edu, HUI being WHOI, short for Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. So HUI Sea Grants, it's housed there. You can also find it at CapeCod.gov from Cape Cod Cooperative Extension. It's available there. We're also in the process of updating the handbook. So soon, early in 2026, you'll see a whole new updated version with lots more information and input from experts, and we will have it available on our website. And we're looking for ways to get it printed as well.
Yeah. So, and if it, you cover everything. I really think there's so much detail in here that we didn't get into. But if you want to get into the nitty gritty, it's in here. All right. Shannon Hulls, Deputy Director of Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, Floodplain and CRS Specialist with Cooperative Extension and HUI Sea Grant. Brian McCormick, Coastal Processes and Hazards Specialist with Cape Cod Cooperative Extension and HUI Sea Grant. Thanks so much. Thanks for all this handy info. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.